Good afternoon. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to On Politics for Thursday, February 16th. We'll have Craig Gilbert in Washington, and in Milwaukee, Jason Stein, Mary Spacuzza, and Dan Bice. But let's get to our headlines first. Well, there's more high drama in Washington, D.C. We'll talk to Craig Gilbert about that. Also, breaking news today, Sean Duffy says no to a Senate bid. Could Sheriff Clark actually be a candidate for that seat? And we'll handicap Governor Walker's budget with Jason Stein. We'll have your winners and losers and questions from our viewers. First, let's go to Craig Gilbert in Washington. So, Craig, been another week of turmoil at the White House and in Washington generally. But before we get to that, there's some news this morning out of Wisconsin. Sean Duffy has decided he will not run against Tammy Baldwin for U.S. Senate in 2018. So what do you make of that? Is this more about Duffy's liabilities or more about Baldwin's strengths?
Well, you know, a lot of things go into these decisions. You know, there could be personal factors. He's got a very large family, a lot of young kids. We don't know exactly why he made this decision. You know, there's no reason for him to have shied away from the race for political reasons. I mean, this is an opportunity race for Republicans. It's a harder race than it would have been if Hillary Clinton had won the presidential election, because it's always harder when your party's in the White House to win a Senate race, but absolutely a real prospect for Republicans. It does an interesting thing to the Republican field. I mean, Sean Duffy's district is a district where Donald Trump was very strong. He had a chance to kind of command the Trump vote and also command the outstate vote. A lot of the people that are thought to be considering a run are from southeastern Wisconsin. So that sort of kind of regional subgroup is pretty crowded right now. Duffy would have had a real shot running from another part of the state against them.
And Duffy was seen as somebody who could raise a lot of money too, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, he's been in Congress. He's had a high media profile. He's had his stumbles in the media, but right. He definitely brought a lot to the race. And if he could have marshaled again the sort of Trump base and the vote in northern and western Wisconsin, it's quite possible that the others in the race would have split up the sort of suburban vote closer to Milwaukee, and it would have been a real, he would have had a very, very good chance of winning a Republican primary.
Well, the recent stumble on CNN with Alison Camerota clearly didn't help him much, but he does, to be fair, he does cite his family in his statement. Let's move to Reince Priebus at the White House Chief of Staff. Politico has a story out this morning that basically says that his problems aren't over. Roger Stone, a close associate of Donald Trump, says there's more revelations to come out about Priebus. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, I mean, his problems are never going to be over, because I think the volatility and to some degree chaos in the Trump White House is probably will never completely end. I mean, they are kind of at the beginning of this presidency. They've gotten off to a really turbulent start. But, you know, this is also this turbulence is also a reflection of the president. It's a reflection of the team he's put together, the factions he's brought together, of his style, of his own unpredictability, of his kind of penchant for speaking out on whatever he feels like speaking out on Twitter. So that is a kind of a minefield for a White House chief of staff, because it's really your job to bring order to chaos when you're White House chief of staff. That job is a pretty monumental one under this president, under these circumstances. And so there are going to be lots of bumps ahead. However long he stays in this job, there are always going to be people who are going to have the knives out for him. It's not going to be smooth sailing.
Well, let's move to Paul Ryan in Congress. As the turmoil continues at the White House, Republicans in Congress still have an agenda they'd like to pass. What's happening with that?
Well, it's also gotten off to a slow start. I mean, they say they're on track, but there are a lot of questions about what shape, you know, they want to do very big and ambitious things. I mean, they want to rewrite the tax code. They want to replace Obamacare. There's talk about infrastructure, border security, deregulation. There's foreign policy issues. But there's confusion again about sort of what the White House wants and what stamp it wants to put on the kind of House agenda. Some of these issues are really, really difficult to legislate on. I mean, when you rewrite the tax code, there are winners, but there are also always going to be losers. And And so it's not, it hasn't been smooth sailing for House Republicans either. They're confronting, particularly in the Senate, a united Democratic opposition, which can really slow things down in the Senate. But even in the House, just because of the kind of broader confusion over and turmoil in the White House, I would say I think they've gotten off to a slower start than they would have liked.
So you wrote this week that congressional Republicans in Wisconsin, the ability they have to maybe distance themselves from President Trump sort of varies directly with how Trump did in their districts. Explain that, and who's in the best position to be independent?
Yeah, so a lot of it depends on, you know, how well Trump is doing overall and how well he's doing with Republican voters. Those are the voters that these Republican congressmen are going to be most responsive to. But if you look at their districts, again, we talked about Sean Duffy. His district was the one where Trump had his biggest winning margin. Trump, clearly, that rural blue-collar strength. So somebody like Sean Duffy probably has less political room in his own district to break with Trump, to disagree with Trump, than someone like Paul Ryan, who, even though he's obviously expected as House Speaker by his membership to be pretty supportive of this president, if you look at his own district, Trump didn't win it by all that much. And Ryan kind of dramatically outperformed Trump in his own district. Jim Sensenbrenner also dramatically outperformed Trump in his district. Very Republican district, but a district where a lot of those conservative Republican voters had big qualms about Trump during the primary. So I think you see some variation across the Republican spectrum in terms of what kinds of pressures these members are going to get from their own constituencies when it comes to some issues where they may have disagreements with Donald Trump and whether they can express them fully or not.
All right, Craig Gilbert, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much.
Next time.
Now I'm back in our Milwaukee studio with Dan Bice, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and reporter Mary Spacuzza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Mary, let me turn to you first. Sean Duffy, as Craig and I just discussed, is not going to run against Tammy Baldwin in 2018. What do you think's going on there?
You know, I think that Republicans obviously think they have a good chance at defeating Tammy Baldwin. That said, it's one thing to think Republicans can win, and it's another to risk your livelihood. So obviously, Representative Duffy cannot run for Senate and House of Representatives at the same time. So should he lose, he would then lose a major source of income for his large family with, I think, eight children. So
yeah.
I would think that might be a factor in the decision.
Well, he said that in his statement. In fairness, he said it's about family.
Yeah, and he said he talked with Rachel and talked and prayed
and
about it.
About how hard it is to make it on his income as it is.
Right, and you know,
kids.
She
still it's 170,000.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's got to be a factor in the decision of, like, what if Senator Baldwin wins and then he's out of a job and all of a sudden, you know, going, I guess he would go back into law maybe. But
so how much do you think the interview on CNN, what was it, last week, what kind of impact did that have? That got terrible reviews pretty much across the board.
Yeah, it was not good. I mean, I think that it was saying that good things came out of the Charleston church shooting where multiple people were killed did not play well. I think that people were
distinguishing between white
terrorism
and Muslim terrorists.
Right.
I think if he really wanted to run, though, if this was, I have my heart set on it, I'm going to do it, that was not great because there are a lot of politicians who have bad interviews or bad appearances. Bill Clinton had a terrible speech at the Democratic convention.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump didn't always do well in his public appearances either.
Right, but if he was really set on it, but I think you do have the issue with the family. I hope he's not going to become the Ron kind of the delegation where his name comes up on everything, but he runs for nothing. I think that was probably a factor, but I wouldn't say it would be a deciding factor.
Okay, so Dan, who might run?
Well, as Craig said, a lot of them are from this area. We have Dale Cuyenga, who's thinking about running. Kevin Nicholson, who's almost nobody knows, but is doing a lot of work planning to run. Leah Vukmir has been mentioned as someone who's thinking about running. Eric Hovde, who ran last time and finished second in the primary for Madison. Those are some of the people who are thinking about running. But it's a pretty open field. I don't think any of those individuals have high name recognition around the state. And the question will be, just as it was the first time Tammy Baldwin ran, will they be able to clear the field for one of these candidates? Mm-hmm. Will it be Eric Hovde? Will it be Kevin Nicholson or whatever? I get the sense that Eric Hovde really wants to run. So unless it's him, there's probably going to be at least a two-way primary.
Well, and Hovde would have an advantage of having a fair amount of money of his own to throw at the race.
Right. That's true. But, you know, they were, in particular, Tommy Thompson and some of the super PACs involved in the last race were able to drive up his negatives late in that race. And despite how much he spent, and he spent a fair bit of money, he ended up still losing to Thompson, who was, you know, incredibly popular and stuff. But, you know, you saw some flaws with Hovde in the first race.
Mm-hmm. So we're not going to see Tommy come out of retirement
again? No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I mean, that was not a pleasant experience for him.
No,
and you know, the problem with him is, since Hovde did have money, he drained the Thompson's campaign of everything, and so the general election started, and it was Tammy Baldwin on the air by herself.
With some very good ads, as I recall.
Yeah, he's not the guy you voted for.
Not the guy you remember. Yeah. All right, so Dan, is Sheriff Clark running?
Well, apparently a lot of people want him to run, and a lot of people are making money off of the possibility that he could run, but I still don't think he will. But, you know, there are now four groups, and I wouldn't be surprised if after today, five or six groups that are trying to raise money. They're raising money saying, send us money, and we'll help convince him to run.
Draft Sheriff Clark.
Draft Sheriff Clark movement. And the first and original Draft Sheriff Clark movement is an odd collection of people, including Dog the Bounty Hunter and other Trump allies. And they started January 17th, and since then, they've raised $300,000 from people around the country. Mm-hmm. And
it's a fair amount of money.
Yeah, and I've heard the Clark people have been getting calls saying, we want to send money, where do we send money? I got emails and calls today from people saying, where should I send money? And so I think it's almost 6,000 people who've given to this effort. So you have that, but then you have three what appear to be pretty questionable or shady groups that are involved in giving money. One is a PAC from Florida. All of these are out of state. The first one's from North Carolina. The second one, called Black PAC for conservative black candidates, is from Florida. It doesn't seem to have spent money on any candidates. And the guy who runs it is a big proponent of Black Lives Matter, which is very bizarre given Clark's position on Black Lives Matter. Hmm. Another one called the Committee to Defend the President. It used to be called Stop Hillary PAC. It's run by a guy who's notorious for running scam PACs. And then a third group called the Restore American Freedom and Liberty Committee. Again, all of its money seems to be going to this one consulting firm in New York by a 20-something-year-old libertarian candidate. So all of them are raising money, and I'm guessing doing quite well. But the first group has already done polling, I understand, extensive polling in Wisconsin. They're going to be one of the big sponsors at the CPAC convention next week, where Sheriff Clark's speaking. And is he going to run, which is the big question, and he's given no indication. In the last half of last year, he raised $13,000, I think.
What about going to work for the Trump administration? Wasn't that the rumor forever that he
I think it still is a possibility.
Well, let's talk about the politics of Clark running. Mary, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here, but what's a path for him if he ran statewide?
I would think that he would do a lot of out-of-state fundraising because his national profile has been running or has been rising as he's been going around the country for Trump. I think he would rely on a lot of out-of-state donations or conservative donations. But even he's had some issues with Wisconsin conservatives who split from him because they feel like he's gone too far. So I think
his polling in Milwaukee County is terrible, as we've seen, even among Republicans.
But I bet he would do well in some of the same areas that Trump did. Well,
I'm sure he would. I think he would. It would just be a question of has he been so divisive that he, and with Trump's if Trump is struggling, would that kind of tie Sheriff Clark?
And you would have to bring up the issue of race too. I mean, I don't think Wisconsin's ever elected a black candidate statewide, has it?
I don't think so.
Louis Butler ran, but I mean, he came close, 51-49 with Gay Woman, but.
Certainly not for U.S. Senate.
Yeah. I mean, it would be an interesting dynamic. I think it would, I think It would be helpful to him if there were multiple candidates instead of just if there were just two or three or something like that. But yeah, and actually, you would find out that he'd have to spend more time in Wisconsin if he ran for Senate.
That he's been spending. All right. Well, speaking of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker put a budget out the other day, and Jason Stein of our Madison Bureau was in Milwaukee actually yesterday, and we chatted about that. And Jason's been digging into it, so let's hear what Jason had to say. So, Jason, you've had a chance to look at the state budget now for a few days and get a better idea of what's in there. How would you handicap some of the proposals that Governor Walker is making to the legislature?
Sure. Well, Dave, I think one thing's clear. There are some things that are going to pass the Republican legislature, I think, pretty easily. One of them is this repeal of prevailing wage and project labor law, you know, sort of removing those from the playing field going forward. I think that's something lawmakers will pass.
You were saying that could be related to transportation funding.
The argument will be made.
Make those projects cheaper to
right.
do.
That's going to be the argument. Yeah. The opponents will push back on that, but I don't think they'll succeed.
Yep.
There'll be some form of tax cuts in this budget, clearly. Mm-hmm. If there'll be the income tax cuts that the governor proposed at the level he proposed, we'll see. I think there's not a good chance for a gas tax increase, just very small chance of that at this point. Also, I don't think it's very likely that the DNR will be split up. As that agency, there had been some talk that the natural resources would be split up. I don't think we're going to see that in this session based on the reaction I've seen so far.
And there's an ongoing reorg there anyway, right?
Right. The governor has proposed sort of a lighter version of that, which would be to just reorganize the agency. I think that will happen, and then the people that want even more will probably in 2 years see, are they satisfied, or do they want to keep pounding away for completely splitting the agency? And then there are a number of issues that I think are more up in the air. So here's several of them. One, there's not going to be a gas tax increase, I think, in this budget, but could there be some form of new revenue for road building in the state? That's something that remains to be seen.
What could that look like? Are we talking tolling?
Not in the short term. In the long term, you know, the state could move towards tolling. The state could increase fees on vehicles, have some kind of registration fee. The state could potentially put new fees, like on hybrids, or do things like that. They could raise revenues from some other part of the state government, and then put those into the road fund, or you could pull spending out of that road fund, like, say, transit spending. You could take it out of that and put it into a fund that's supported by sales and income taxes rather than gas taxes. But then people aren't going to like that because then they compete with schools for that money, and you know that'll rub some people the wrong way.
So what else is on your list of maybes?
A UW tuition cut that the governor wants. Republican lawmakers have just not reacted well to that. At the same time, as we were just talking about, it could be very popular out in the public domain. So I think it'll be up to whether or not the public convinces Republican lawmakers to go along with that or not. The governor obviously wants quite a bit of new money for K-12 schools and some for the University of Wisconsin as well. I don't think Republicans are going to go along with all of that money. So it's a question of they will go along with some of it. How much will they go along with? And then the governor has a number of changes he wants to make to welfare programs to require more able-bodied people to be working to receive benefits, get tested for drugs, just a whole variety of things. Some of those are clearly going to be passed by Republican lawmakers. I think the question will be, how much will the legislature and the federal government, which has very often a say in these matters, how much will they ultimately sign off on and will we see put into practice in the next 2 years?
Let me back up to the tuition cut. As you pointed out, that would seem to be a fairly popular thing among the general public.
The public likes paying less.
The public always likes paying less.
And paying more, they don't like that.
They don't like that. So why wouldn't Republican lawmakers go for that?
You know, I think it in some ways it may have been as simple as they have been freezing tuition for UW schools for 4 years now, and I think they felt that was working well, that that was popular with their constituents, and that maybe they had quelled a little bit the criticism of the cost of higher ed. So I don't think they went into this budget thinking there was a huge problem there. The governor really did not consult them, that I've heard about that policy. So I think they were blindsided by it and may ultimately feel like they don't have any buy-in for that proposal. And I think if they approve it, it will be because they hear from people out in their districts that say, boy, you know, that tuition cut, I really like that
right.
idea.
Okay. Well, Jason Stein, thanks so much.
Thank
Appreciate
you, Dave.
It. All right, now it's time for our favorite part of the show, winners and losers. And Dan, I'm going to turn to you first. Who's so already, your winner?
I already showed my hand once. my winner is the groups profiting off of Sheriff Clark. They're obviously raising a lot of money, and people realize they can raise money off this. The only thing is, we're still waiting for Sheriff Clark to say anything about this. He's yet to say a word about whether he's okay with this, not okay with it, whatever.
So well, surely he must be flattered, if nothing else.
Well, I'm sure it does fire his ego, but still, you also don't want to be associated with groups that support Black Lives Matter or scam packs.
Avery so, David Clark. All right, who's your loser?
My loser's Andrew Puzder, the Labor nominee who was forced to withdraw, the first of the Trump nominees to withdraw. You know, he had, first of all, the Oprah tape was not a good thing for him, but he also had people on the left who disliked his position on the minimum wage, people on the right who didn't like his position on immigration in the past, or some social conservatives who didn't like the ads for Carl Jr.'s and for Hardee's and stuff. Mm-hmm. So he was pushed from both sides. The selection by Trump now, Alexander Acosta, I'm assuming has had more vetting than Mr. Puzder did.
But, you know, to be fair to Trump, all presidents have problems occasionally getting their cabinet secretaries confirmed.
And it's become much more polarized. I was just looking at, in the past, you know, with Bill Clinton, his nominee with the fewest votes got 85 votes. I mean, today...
it's hard to imagine anyone getting 85 votes.
I mean, there might be some, but you have two things going on here. One, the margin for error is very slim with only 52 Republicans in the Senate. Plus, Trump is putting forward some people who are controversial. And so that combination means that it's more likely that you're going to have more fights on these issues. And with Obama, I mentioned some other. Obama, the candidate he had with the fewest votes was Tom Perez with 54. But having said that, it is true, as we were discussing, that that the Attorney General for Bill Clinton did have to withdraw. So, yes, all of them do have issues on that. But it does seem to be a little less vetting than you would expect on some of these candidates.
All right. Mary, who's your loser?
I think Michael Flynn would have to be the loser for me. You know, he didn't even make it, 2 months?
24 days, I think.
Yeah.
Not even one month.
So it was a pretty short tenure for him. He obviously was saying, you know, he didn't discuss the sanctions with Russian officials. Then turned out that he was wiretapped, or surveillance showed that he did. Apparently lied to the vice president. There was obviously discrepancy among the Trump folks, whether he resigned, was forced to resign, asked to resign, fired. Either way, he's out of a job. So, yeah. Loser.
There have been some reports that Mike Pence basically, behind the scenes, said this guy's got to go. I know. We can't stand for this.
If he lied to the vice president's face about what he discussed, and then there's apparently transcripts or tapes or whatever of him discussing it, that's going to be a problem.
Yep.
So.
All right, so who's your winner?
I think winner, Sally Yates, going back to that issue. This was the acting attorney general who was fired by Trump for refusing to defend his executive order. Turns out that she had actually been the one warning a month or so ago that Flynn had been in touch with the Russians discussing sanctions, that he was being less than forthcoming or misleading with his statements. And then the Trump administration went ahead and repeated those statements to the public. So I think this kind of comes back as probably a good day for her.
Well, there's still this question with Trump apparently knowing that Flynn had not been truthful.
He knew for a while.
Telling a couple of weeks at least. And not telling Pence, apparently. So there's a lot of questions about
that. And then he's blaming the leaks and saying this is because of illegal leaks, and it's, you know.
Big Twitter storm yesterday about that.
Oh, right. And so I think the question is, if Flynn hadn't gotten caught lying, would he still have his job? If, you know, gotten caught publicly, if yeah. Trump knew would and nobody else did, would he have?
And shifting the focus to leaks does seem to have worked with many of Trump's supporters. I've just been listening to some conservative talk radio, and that does seem to be the focus of the discussion on conservative talk radio. Why is the intelligence department leaking, and why is the press writing this stuff? You know, for us, it's not an issue as to whether they should or shouldn't leak. If it's a good story, we run with it. But it does seem
well, and it's also funny because it seems to confirm that it's accurate. If you're saying this information was leaked by the intelligence community, right. It's like, oh, so it's pretty right on then. It's right. Not exactly fake news.
All right, so let's go to a couple of viewer questions. The first one is, who is more vulnerable headed into 2018, Mary, Tammy Baldwin or Scott Walker?
Okay, so I think this is going to be a bit of a wait and see for a couple of reasons. If Trump is really struggling, that's going to help Baldwin because, you know, he's a Republican president. This is a mid-year election for him. If people are really unhappy with his performance or they're losing their health care, that benefits Tammy. I think that if he gains popularity and Republicans still kind of continue this wave, that's going to work against her. And obviously people are gunning for her seat. That said, Scott Walker, who, you know, he's had low approval ratings. He's been, he's struggled, especially during his presidential run. But who is going to run against him remains a question.
Yeah, I think that's the big question. You don't beat an established candidate. Nobody in the list of candidates thinking about running against Scott Walker right now, I think by everyone's calculations, is a pretty unimpressive list. I think the people lining up against Tammy Baldwin, much more established, and at least in one case, someone with a lot of money. So I would have to say right now that probably Baldwin appears a little more vulnerable.
So here's a question about Michael Flynn. Dan, I'll turn to you on this one. It's really questioning the media's response to the Flynn affair. Mm-hmm. Can the so-called liberal media hold off on all assumptions until something is found to be true? In this case, the viewer suggests that Flynn actually didn't lie, at least to the FBI, and is comparing Flynn's performance to that of Hillary Clinton, where asking where was the media speculation regarding Hillary Clinton?
Well, all over the place.
It was, but it's also funny what you're talking about with the media, with the reporting. The reporting, I don't think, has gotten it too far ahead of anything right now. The reporting, particularly at the New York Times and Washington Post, has been methodical, in my understanding. It's been one thing and then leads to another. I think it's the talking heads who might have gotten ahead, but that's what talking heads do, is get ahead of themselves. So
that is what they do. All right, Mary, one more question.
Okay.
We'll have time for one more. And this
sure.
is about a story that you did regarding a landlord who had some problems at his property.
Mm-hmm.
And the viewer wants to know, so what's a landlord supposed to do? Is he supposed to check up on his properties every day, go through their garbage? I mean, how is a landlord supposed to know what's going on, I'm summarizing here, mm-hmm. in their units? And maybe describe the story briefly for viewers who haven't seen
sure.
it. Sure. And then address the question.
So earlier this week, a landlord was sued by the city of Milwaukee. The city attorney's office alleges that he owns 12 properties in Milwaukee. They say that they were used as drug and prostitution houses, that there were repeated warnings and notifications from police that there was drug sales, drug manufacturing, prostitution going on. He didn't fix the issues, continued to rent to people. They actually interviewed a confidential informant who said that he would accept extra $1,000 payments in cash to essentially look the other way and allow drug sales to continue. Obviously, those are all allegations, and we'll have to see how the case plays out in court. But I think that this is a little different, and the question is basically, I don't think anybody expects a landlord to do full surveillance on their tenants and know if they smoke a joint or how much beer they're drinking or, you know, I think that
or,
it's...
Or whatever it is.
Or whatever they might be doing. So I think that nobody expects a landlord to check on a tenant, what is it, every day. But I think that this, you know, according to at least what the city says, this was a slightly different situation where this was repeat red flags flying in the breeze, right. And that the landlord either knew Well, apparently they're saying he knew and did nothing and actually got extra money.
And this is being done in the context of a series that Carrie Spivak did, a larger series on landlords who are ignoring all of the problems at some of their properties, racking up hundreds and in some cases more than 1,000 housing code violations, yet didn't pay any of the fines on that stuff, yet continue to buy more and more property. So we're not talking about someone who might have one problem or two problems. We're talking about someone with vast amounts of problems. Right.
And they did mention some code violations. I didn't see going through other court records. I saw quite a few evictions for him, of him evicting tenants. I didn't see anything about, you know, tax liens or unpaid bills. So it sounds like that wasn't an issue as much as that he was, you know, basically creating nuisance properties.
There's activity here that the city's claiming he at least should have known about.
That he should have known about and got contacted by police multiple times. They said multiple houses that he owned were designated drug houses by MPD repeatedly over the years. So there were some drive-by shootings, things like that.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Mary Spicuzza, thanks for being with us. Dan Bice, also Craig Gilbert in Washington, and Jason Stein. I'm David Haynes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for joining us again for On Politics.